Ahead, everyone. So there's a breakdown of Trump's tax plan that I want to get to from the Tax Policy Center. And wow, Trump's tax plan is basically the worst thing ever. I'll give you the numbers on that. And then we're going to talk about Paul Begala, Democratic strategist, big-time Democratic insider, kind of epitomizing the problem with this Russia frenzy. Wait until you hear what he's calling for. And then Donald Trump went on Pat Robertson's show and just gave us a plethora of hilarious little sound bites to talk about. And guess what? There's a buddy-buddy situation developing between George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and the media can't get enough of it. So we'll talk about all this and more. Sit back, relax. Let's get started here, and we're going to do it with the very serious stuff on Trump's tax plan. Some experts and economists decided to crunch the numbers on Trump's tax plan, and the results are comically bad. I mean, there's no other way to put it. So listen to this. This is from Vox. A new analysis by the Tax Policy Center finds that the tax cuts included in the Trump administration's outline for tax reform released in April could cut federal revenues by as much as $7.8 trillion over 10 years. And the benefits would go almost exclusively to the top 5% of earners. Excuse me. I got the remnants of a granola bar stuck in my throat. All right. Let's continue. Even if the plan included some very large tax hikes to offset the cuts, like doing away with personal exemptions and other common deductions, and taking into account effect on economic growth, the cost still comes to $3.4 trillion over 10 years. Let me pause here. So they're saying best case scenario is it's going to cost $3.4 trillion. Worst-case scenario, or actually the most likely scenario, is that it would cut federal revenues by as much as $7.8 trillion over 10 years. So reflect on that. Here we have the party that claims to be really concerned about the debt, and they say they're fiscally responsible deficit hawks, but what they're proposing, it leaves a giant hole in the budget, just an absolutely giant hole. Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. Now, the reason why this is the case is the Republicans basically make shit up in their math when they try to tell you what their budget will do. So they use this thing called dynamic scoring, which is just utter bullshit. What it does is it assumes the economy is going to grow at a preposterous rate because built into their models is the idea that when you do tax cuts for the rich and you deregulate, you unleash the beast of the capitalist system. And then there's so much wealth creation that even though you're cutting the tax rate, you somehow increase the revenue to the government. I need you to realize how ridiculous that is. They say by cutting the taxes of the rich and deregulating, you're actually going to increase revenue to the government. Basic math would tell you that's not true, But they say, yeah, but you're not taking into account how much the economy is going to grow when we unleash the beast by doing tax cuts and deregulation. But the problem with that is history. Every time throughout American history, when we've cut taxes for the rich and deregulated, the economy goes through a boom-bust cycle where, oh, everything takes off. Oh, my God, things are going great. Things will never go bad again. Oh, goodness gracious, there was a crash. So it happened with the Great Depression. Remember the Roaring Twenties? People thought, oh, my God, the good times are never going to end. It's the Roaring Twenties. And then we had the Depression in the 30s. Well, in 1929 was the crash, and then, you know, 1930s Depression. So, and same thing with the Great Recession. You had tax cuts for the rich, deregulation, and that's what happened. But what they're saying is, no, this time when we do tax cuts for the rich and deregulation, I don't know what you're talking about. It's going to be great, and it's going to be so good that the $7.8 trillion that we're going to cost the government, don't even have to worry because it's going to be made up for, because when we cut taxes, we're somehow going to get even more money to the government. So even George H.W. Bush, a Republican, called this mentality and philosophy that's taken over the Republican Party voodoo economics. He said it's voodoo because it's not true. Like, you're saying that this is what's going to happen, but it doesn't happen. So think about that. When George H.W. Bush is the voice of reason, and he's like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. You suck at basic math. All right, so let's continue here. They say, the cost would be even greater once you take into account the interest the U.S. would have to pay on all that debt. For context, a $3.4 trillion tax cut would amount to about 12% of GDP in 2027, slightly larger than all the tax cuts George W. Bush passed while in office. All right, so do you understand what they're saying there? When you just take into account the interest that has to be paid on the debt, that alone would equal the cost or be slightly larger than the cost of all of Bush's tax cuts. So when I say Trump's plan is the Bush tax cuts on steroids and human growth hormone, that is exactly what I mean. It makes those look like peanuts. Oh, God, this is such a bad idea. It's unbelievable how bad an idea this is. But look, this is what you get when you have Goldman Sachs write the tax plan. You know, the people who rigged the economy, the people who committed fraud, it was part of their business model. They only wrote the tax plan to benefit the rich and the corporations and Wall Street. They don't give a fuck about the outcomes. They don't give a fuck about the debt or the deficit or the American people or shifting the burden onto the middle class. They don't care. It's all about their self-interest. They continue, the package, the TPC fines, would overwhelmingly help the wealthy, including the tax hikes. The overall plan would give the average family earning under $25,000 per year a $40 tax cut, or a 0.3% boost in after-tax income. The top 0.1% earning above $3.4 million a year would get an average tax cut of $937,700, or a 13.3% boost in after-tax income. So it's a giant giveaway of nearly $1 million each to people in the top 0.1%. Meanwhile, everybody making $25,000 a year or less would only get an extra $40. And by the way, remember, it's half the country that makes $30,000 a year or less. So we're talking about, you know, when they say, yeah, we're looking out for the regular guy, the little guy, the average Joe, the forgotten man will never be forgotten again. That is complete horseshit. Because the amount of money that basically the bottom 50% is getting, it's like $40. Top 0.1%, they get an extra about $1 million a year. Look, you have to understand, that's the point of Republican policies. The point is to pretend that, oh, we're here to look out for everybody. That's what we're looking out for, regular people. That's the whole point of our tax plan. And what they'll do is, hear me now, quote me later, it's a guarantee. They will sell it and they will push it as if it's, well, tax cut for the middle class, tax cut for the middle class, tax cut for the middle class, tax cut for the middle class for regular people. But then again, they did the same thing with the Bush tax cuts, but you dive into the details And you find out very quickly, no, you're just wrong, that it's a giant tax cut for the rich, and people who are middle class or poor get next to nothing. So I need you to understand, it is a trick. It is complete and utter bullshit. The whole point of the Republican Party is to serve the rich. Look, everybody knows I'm not, it's not like I'm soft on the Democrats. I mean, I'm one of the co-founders of Justice Democrats. We're primarying the corporate Democrats. But just understand, the Democratic Party, while there are many corrupt sellouts within it, we're talking about anywhere from a 50% sellout to an 80% sellout. The Republican Party is just jam-packed full of 100% sellouts. The entire party's philosophy is a mix of Christian fundamentalism and 100% corporatism and selling out to the rich. And every policy they release proves it. It's not like they don't even, point is, they don't even like throw you a bone every now and then. With the corporate Democrats, every now and then they'll throw you a bone and they'll be like, okay, here's like a kind of shitty reform but still helps with Obamacare, will protect people with pre-existing conditions. Like every now and then they'll give you a little something. The Republicans, woo, yeah, fuck up, are you rich? We don't like you. Anyway, actually we do like you. We're looking out for the middle class. No, you're not. Your policies are comically bad. Comically bad. And then another thing they're going to do, but we don't need to get too much into this, is they're going to try to do a tax repatriation deal. So what that is we have trillions of dollars worth of wealth that corporations keep in offshore bank accounts. So they're doing that to dodge paying taxes. Now, right off the bat, we already have a sketchy situation, because if you or I decide to take our money and dump it in an offshore bank account, we have the feds knocking on our door in 15 minutes. What are you doing? Come on, you want to go to prison? Is that what you want? Corporations do it, and now all of a sudden they need to make a deal. Like, what do you mean make a deal? They're breaking the law, so fucking crack down on them, enforce the law. No, see, what we're going to do is we're going to have a deal, we're going to have a tax holiday, going to do repatriation, and they're going to bring the money back into the country. And what they'll do is, they'll say, okay, we'll let you bring it back in the country and your tax rate will be like 7%. What are you talking about? They owe 30% on that money. Yeah, 7%. It'll be. You think they'll do that for you? You have your money overseas? All right, we're really mad that you're dodging your taxes and putting it overseas, but you know what? Just give us 7% and everything will be fine. No, they'll say fucking pay your taxes or you're going to get locked up. Corporations, since they bought the government, they own the government, they go, yeah, we're just going to keep it over there, unless you give us a sweetheart deal. And then the Republicans and the Democrats in this instance will try to spin it like, oh, we have a great deal. See, what we're going to do with that money is we're going to set up an infrastructure bank and we're bringing the money back in the country and it's going to create jobs here and it's going to do this and it's going to do that. First of all, studies show when you do repatriation, they don't create jobs here. They don't. They just don't. And second of all, they have to try to spin it as positive and a good thing for everybody, when in reality they're getting away with robbery. They're going to save billions and billions of dollars by cheating the system. And they also shift the tax burden onto regular people. It used to be the case, corporations pay a historically low percentage of the tax burden. They used to pay a much higher percentage, but then they bought the government. And now they get away with virtually anything. So all these, it's all bullshit to trick you and to let the rich run out the back door with all the money, and even barely glossing over the details of any analysis of a Republican tax plan proves that. Okay. All right, next. I saw this on the Twitter feed yesterday from David Sirota. I wanted to share it with all of you. He says, when you could be promoting an expansion of your own party's most popular program, Medicare, and yet you still think it's the West Wing. And, of course, he's responding to Senator Tim Kaine's tweet there. Tim Kaine said this gem. Retweet if you want Senate Republicans to start over and work with Democrats on a bipartisan plan to improve the health care system. Tim, what are you doing? Really? You still, at this late date, you still don't get it? Like, so here's the deal. When you talk about average Joe Republicans, just regular people in the middle of the country, you poll those people, and those people on many issues, not on all, in my opinion, but on many issues, they're pretty reasonable. So they'll say, yeah, I don't want to cut Social Security. I don't want to cut Medicaid or Medicare. I think the rich should pay higher taxes. I believe in raising the minimum wage. Now, we might have some disagreements on social issues and whatnot, but they're pretty reasonable. Those people, we could work with, no problem. Regular people, of course. The Republican Party, the party establishment in Washington, no, there is going to be no holding hands and singing kumbaya and crafting a bipartisan deal because they're monsters. Look at every single proposal they've had over health care. The entire point is geared towards rigging the system in favor of the rich and in favor of the corporations, the private health insurance companies, big pharma. Again, don't take my word for it. Look at any of the reviews of their proposals. I mean, look at the CBO. They say, oh, your health care bill cuts $800 billion from Medicaid. Wow. It gives $200,000 to every person in the top 0.1%. You're kicking 28 million people off of their health insurance, more people, to a total of about 50 million people who aren't going to have health insurance within 10 years. So you go through and you look at everything they're for, when you objectively measure it, it doesn't improve the system. It makes it significantly worse, which is hard to do given that we already have a shitty system because Obamacare is a piecemeal approach that leaves the private health insurance system intact. So there is no working with them. There is no, hey, you're a reasonable counterparty and let's talk it out and come to some sort. No. You defeat them. You crush them under your boot. That's the only approach. You twist their arm and use political pressure to force them to the proper positions. Medicare for all, by the way, is the answer. 60% of the American people want Medicare for all. 60%. There are polls that show there are more Republicans that want it than do not want it. It's a plurality of Republicans who say, yeah, Medicare for all sounds good. So, are you fucking Tim Kaine? What are you talking about? This is the same kind of nonsensical Washington bubble bullshit kind of thinking that's like fake wisdom, you know? Like, that's fake wisdom right there. Retweet if you want Senate Republicans to start over and work with Democrats on a bipartisan plan to improve the healthcare system. There's nothing inherently good about bipartisanship. Because usually when Democrats and Republicans in the party establishment in Washington are agreeing to something, it's agreeing to screw you over and serve the corporations. So no, you have to crack some skulls in order to get it done. You have to use the power of the people, and you have to push for these things. But guess what? I'm bringing this up as if Tim Kaine is like an ally and he's really for these things. He's not for Medicare for all. Of course he's not for Medicare for all. He's one of the corporate of the corporate Democrats, one of the most corporate. I mean, there's a guy who supported TPP. So it frustrates me because the people who are supposed to be the more reasonable party, the sane party, the ones who are looking out more for the people, this is the kind of shit that they think like, oh, this will help us in the next election and we'll look really reasonable. Let's be centrist and find bipartisanship. But if the Republican Party is super duper far right and the Democratic Party is center right, then your bipartisanship, your centrism between those two points is just far right. The Republicans are far, far right. You're center right. If you meet in the middle from there, you're far right. So that's the problem. There is no actual left pushing for the right policies that the American people want. And that's what we're here to fix, by the way, Justice Democrats. So justicedemocrats.com/donate. We're trying to raise money for our candidates because we're at an institutional disadvantage because we can't go to corporations or PACs and take money from them and then be fine when you go to a few of them. A lot of corporate Democrats can do that. So we need many donations, small dollar donations from many people. And this is the only way to move forward and where we can know our politicians are not bought. So that's the model we're taking. And what we stand for is very clear. Go to justicedemocrats.com/platform to learn about it, because we're so sick of this kind of garbage thinking, which they think is reasonable, but actually it's just incredibly stupid. Okay. Okay. Now we are going to go to Congressman Steve King. And we'll do this one and then take our first break. All right, where are you, Steve? There you are. Okay, here we go. Congressman Steve King went on CNN where he came up with a genius idea to pay for Trump's border wall. Let's watch.
I'd like to say to America, a wall is not a fence, it's not a virtual, it's not a balloon in the air, it's not a drone. It's a wall. It's a concrete wall, and it's 2,000 miles of concrete wall.
And it's $1.6 billion. I mean, that's what might be holding up, you know, the funding for the government. But are you comfortable, Congressman, with providing $1.6 billion of taxpayer money, not from Mexico, to build that wall?
Absolutely, yes, and more. And I'd throw another $5 billion on the pile, and I would find a half of $1 billion of that right out of Planned Parenthood's budget. And the rest of it could come out of food stamps and the entitlements that are being spread out for people that haven't worked in three generations. We've got to put America back to work. This administration will do it. And we've got to free them up so that they can and support the right agenda for this country.
You want to take food from people who are the people who are on the lowest rung in terms of the nation's safety net, and their children, in terms of food stamps. You're happy to take, you're willing to take money from them to build the 1.6, or to give the 1.6 billion for the border wall.
For a couple of reasons. One of them would be that, you know, we will create the kind of security that would bring about 10 million new jobs in America just by enforcing immigration law. Second thing is, I wouldn't impose anything any more strict on anybody in America than what Michelle Obama did with her school lunch program. And so I would just say, let's limit it to that. Anybody that wants to have food stamps up to the school lunch program, that's fine. And but we have seen this go from 19 million people on now SNAP program up to 47 million people on the SNAP program.
And you don't think all of them need it?
Oh, I'm sure that all of them didn't need it.
There's something about Steve King that I like, because he's so stupid and so out there that, you know, it's interesting to watch somebody who wears it on his sleeve and is just unapologetic about it. So where do I begin with that one? First of all, yeah, there's been an increase of people on food stamps. They're using a measurement from before the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession and after the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession. So, in other words, the Republicans did massive, gargantuan tax cuts for the rich and further deregulation of Wall Street. The economy crashed. And then when people who lost their jobs, lost their livelihoods, needed food, they go, oh, how dare you? What's wrong with you? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So you put in place policies that absolutely crashed the economy. Millions of people lost their jobs. They have to turn to food stamps to feed their kids. And you go, oh, look at you, fucking moocher, parasite. Guys act like everybody who's poor, it's like they wake up in the morning and they're like, all right, how can we scam the system today? Woo, I love this. Let's never work again. Let's never even try to get a job. Let's just leech off everybody else. They act like poverty is a choice, that everybody who's poor is sitting back and making that decision, and also that poor people are living high on the hog, and they're like, they have it really well. Like, in their mind, the rich are the oppressed, and the poor people are the oppressors. That's how Steve King thinks. Okay, so then he talks about how, well, the border wall is going to cost $1.6 billion. I thought you were a fiscal conservative. You're just going to spend $1.6 billion on a wall? And he's like, yeah, not only would I do that, I'd add another $5 billion to boot. Oh, I see. So fiscal conservatism, yet again, Steve King is piece of evidence number 9,762. Fiscal conservatism only applies to programs that would help regular people. They never care about, oh my God, the debt, the deficit, when it comes to, you know, priorities that are for giant corporations, when it comes to the military-industrial complex, when it comes to Wall Street, when it comes to enforcing a dumbass immigration policy. Blank check. Blank check in those areas. In areas that I prefer, big government all day long. In areas that I don't, small government. Okay, then just stop pretending that one of your key priorities is fiscal responsibility and being a deficit hawk and prioritizing pinching pennies, because that's not the case. If you are, you know, in favor of a certain policy position, you say, fuck it, blank check. Then he says, well, yeah, in order to fund it, we'd cut Planned Parenthood and food stamps. These guys, they love to have it both ways, because they'll say, Steve King will go on and on about how abortion is wrong and evil and you can't do it and it should be outlawed and it should be banned. And then you say to him, okay, so obviously you want to increase funding for free clinics, Planned Parenthood, contraception, the pill, condoms, sex education, right? And he goes, no, I don't want to do that. Well, you have to do one or the other. You want to decrease the abortion rate? You have to fund those things. He goes, no, I want to not fund those things and somehow decrease the abortion rate also. Well, then you're a fucking moron, because that's not going to happen. You're not living in the real world. You actually can decrease the abortion rate if you fund Planned Parenthood, all of the free clinics, condoms, contraception, sex education. But they want to have their cake and eat it too. No, we don't want to do that, but I also want to cut the abortion rate. And then for the food stamps point, Steve King loves to think of himself as a Christian. Like, yep, I'm a good Christian. I like to follow Jesus' example. Anyway, can we take food out of the mouths of poor kids to fund a border wall to prevent brown people from coming in here? Look, man, you want to have that opinion? Okay. But why do you have to fucking pretend in the next breath that you're Mr. Uber Christianity and Western civilization is great? And anyway, let's not let any brown people in, and let's, you know, take food out of the mouth of hungry kids. They find a way to spin it, of course. And there's enough shitty stuff in the Bible where they have backing for their, you know, far-right view of the world and treating the poor like shit. And then the final point is the Michelle Obama thing. Like, Steve King is one of those, you know those dolls where you pull it and it says something? It has, like, three phrases or whatever? That's Steve King. Like, Michelle Obama's school lunch program, he just brings that up out of nowhere because these guys get mad over the most ridiculous shit. Oh, I'm still mad at Michelle Obama's school lunch program. Disgusting. She wanted kids to, like, eat healthy. Bitch. What the fuck? How are you bringing that up? What the fuck does that have to do with everything else that you're talking about? I have no idea. But there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Steve King would love to fund that border wall with money that's supposed to go for food for hungry people and Planned Parenthood. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, Paul Begala, Democratic insider, has some questionable ideas on Russia. And then Donald Trump's interview with Pat Robertson, yippee skippy. That's going to be interesting, all that stuff. Stay right there.
No. the left, the left. I feel like I'm the left, real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me slap you with the left, the left. You will face so one.
We back, bitches.
The left, the left.
Oh, yes, we
like
is.
I'm the left, real nigga left,
okay.
The left. It's like.
Okay, now let's get to a pretty serious one. Paul Begala is a longtime Democratic insider. He's also a commentator on CNN and a Democratic strategist. And he more or less epitomized the problem with this Trump-Russia frenzy. This happened earlier this week. Take a look.
Patriotic America should subvert an election with a hostile foreign power. That is what Donald Trump Jr. agreed to do with Mr. Kushner and Mr. Manafort in the meeting. We were and are under attack by a hostile foreign power, and they seem to be abetting that hostile foreign power. We should be debating how many sanctions we should place on Russia or whether we should blow up the KGB or GSU, GRU, we should be retaliating massively. Because, by the way, if I were a Trump supporter, I would want to retaliate massively because it has tainted his victory.
You know, we used to point out, hey, I don't like the direction the Democrats are going in here because it has overtly hawkish undertones. Well, now the undertones are overtones. Now they're just saying it. And I remember the first time I really got the slap in the face of like, oh, the arguments being used by the Democrats on Russia, like the end result is really, really bad policy. That was when Rachel Maddow did a segment where she claimed if Donald Trump removes NATO troops from Russia's border. By the way, an incredible provocation, just incredible provocation. If Trump removes the troops from Russia's border, that is somehow proof that Vladimir Putin has, a pee-pee tape of him. Remember that whole, the dossier of, oh, yeah, Trump, had, like, hookers pee on the bed or something in Russia. And Rachel Maddow was saying, yeah, the proof of that would be if he removes the troops from Russia's border. So now you put it, your position is it would be a bad thing to de-escalate from the brink of war with another nuclear armed power. It would be a negative thing if we remove troops from Russia's border, if we remove NATO troops from Russia's border. That's not a good road to go down, man. We should be in favor of diplomacy. We should be in favor of negotiations. We should be in favor of peace. This is what the Democratic Party was supposed to be about. I mean, Obama, for all of his faults on the issue of Russia, he was kind of clear. He mocked Romney in the debates when Romney said Russia's, the biggest geopolitical threat. He said the 1980s called. They want their foreign policy back. Now, you could argue, well, look, things have changed since then because they allegedly were the ones who gave the DNC emails to WikiLeaks, and then WikiLeaks ran with them, and that influenced the election. But here's the problem with that line of reasoning. We should have seen the DNC emails. We should have seen the DNC emails. I don't give a fuck how they came out. We should have seen them. It shows how the sausage is made. It shows that there was massive corruption, a massive bias against Bernie Sanders at an institutional level at the DNC. Donna Brazile was slipping Hillary Clinton questions. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was pressuring the media about how, oh, you're not giving us fair coverage. They tried to hide the debates in order to keep Hillary's advantage. They tried to atheist shame Bernie Sanders in the Midwest, and the list goes on and on. Hillary's own words about how there's bigotry, there's a fervor of bigotry against the rich in this country, and we need totally free and open trade borders, and you should have public positions and private positions as a politician. I mean, don't blame the messenger. That's the point. The point is, you don't just get to say, illegal leaks, bad. Well, that's the same argument that Democrat or progressives were mad when people tried to use that argument against Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. Illegal action, bad. And the response is, yeah, but we should have known that information. That's a good thing that we got that information. It's positive that we got that information. People should say the same thing about the DNC leaks. So, it's just partisan hackery to the max that this is happening. And now you have people like Paul Begala flat out saying it. We should at the very least be debating how many more sanctions to put on Russia. By the way, we are sanctioned out. We already have a tremendous amount of sanctions on Russia. I don't know how they could even craft more. He says, or be debating how we should, blow up certain things in Russia. So start a military conflict with another nuclear armed power. This is the extent that the fervor and the hysteria has gotten to. So, I've taken a lot of heat for my position on this whole thing from the beginning. But the chickens are coming home to roost with the kind of arguments that the Democrats have been making all along. I mean, if you really believe wholeheartedly and fully that there was some sort of illegal, nefarious interference, unacceptable, into the election that put Trump in, then, yeah, isn't the next step to say, well, we should go to war with them? Do you think that's the right course of action? Because if you don't think that's the right course of action, then maybe deep down you kind of know that this frenzy and hysteria really is frenzy and hysteria. And the extent to which they allegedly interfered in the election, if it was somehow getting the DNC emails to WikiLeaks, we should have seen those emails anyway, so I don't care. I do not care. So there you have it, Paul Begala. His answer is perhaps war with Russia. Seems like a bad idea to me. All right, now let's go to Trump and Pat Robertson. This should be fun. All right, which one? I got a whole bunch of them here for you. Here we go. Donald Trump went on Pat Robertson's show, the 700 Club. I read a funny comment on YouTube about this. People said, oh, it's an aptly named show because I think Pat Robertson is 700. But Trump said a bunch of stupid stuff, unsurprisingly. This is probably my favorite, though. Here they are talking about Russia and Hillary.
We used to have that thing called mutually excused destruction of man, and it's still there because he can hurt us, he can decimate our country, and we can do the same thing to him.
It's something you don't even like talking about, but again, we're the most powerful country in the world, and we are getting more and more powerful because I'm a big military person. As an example, if Hillary had won, our military would be decimated. Mm-hmm. Our energy would be much more expensive. That's what Putin doesn't like about me. And that's why I say, why would he want me? Because from day one, I wanted a strong military. He doesn't want to see that. Mm-hmm. And from day one, I want fracking and everything else to get energy prices low and to create tremendous energy. We're going to be self-supporting. We just about are now. We're going to be exporting energy. He doesn't want that. He would like Hillary.
Okay. He's such a bullshitter, it's amazing. Look, the reality is, during the campaign, yeah, of course Russia would have preferred Trump. Trump, during the campaign, was saying over and over how, we need to stay out of Syria, and to the extent that we're in Syria, obviously we shouldn't be on the side of the rebels, because the rebels are jihadists, they're bad guys, and Assad, even though he's a bad guy, he's like the lesser of two evils, and, we prefer he comes out in that conflict, and Hillary was saying the opposite. Hillary was saying, oh, no, we need to get involved and we need to be on the side of the rebels. And, of course, that's directly against Russia and one of their top allies, so they're going to be against that. Hillary was also just openly for more punitive actions over Crimea and is for a more aggressive NATO and is for fully backing NATO. And Trump was questioning, hey, maybe people in NATO should pay more. And Hillary said we might have to go to war over cyber crimes with Russia. So, yeah, Don, stop. Like, he's such a fucking bullshitter. He can't help himself. He's whatever fucking dumbass thought pops in his mind, he just spews it. But, like, you know that's not true. You know it's not true that Putin preferred, you know, Hillary over you. But look, to be fair, if the reasoning was Syria, which I think it was, yeah, on Syria, I made the argument that Trump was making more sense than Hillary during the campaign because Hillary wanted us to get more involved and double down on the conflict and double down on the rebels. And I thought that was a horrible idea because if you topple Assad, you get a Saddam-like situation. You have a vacuum in the Middle East, and who's going to fill it? People who believe in secular democracy? No, jihadists are going to fill it. But, of course, Trump, since he got in office, now he is listening to the neocons and doing exactly what Hillary would have done, which is he's repeatedly attacked the Syrian side, the Syrian troops, Syrian-aligned troops. He's getting more and more involved militarily, so he's doing what Hillary would have done anyway. But it's a bullshit line to say, oh, no, I mean, yeah, of course, Russia would have preferred Hillary to me. You know that's not true. And then, again, here's how you know he's so full of shit. He said if Hillary won, the military would be decimated. Hold on now, Don. You argued many times during the campaign the problem with Hillary wasn't that she's too weak. The problem with Hillary is she's too hawkish. You said it. Hey, Iraq, she voted for Iraq. What a horrible idea. What a terrible idea. We wasted all that money. She was for Libya, the action in Libya. What a horrible idea. What a waste of money. What a waste of resources. You know, we could have rebuilt our infrastructure with the money used for Iraq. You said it over and over. So which is it, dipshit? You can't have it both ways. It can't be, oh, Hillary's so weak. Hillary's incredibly weak. If Hillary won, the military would be decimated. It can't be that, and then also, oh, my God, she's so hawkish. Because those are opposites. She's weak. She's too strong. She's too weak. She's too strong. Which is it? And then finally, yeah, no, Putin doesn't want me. He wants Hillary because, you know, I'm in favor of fracking. Hillary's Secretary of State pushed fracking around the world. So stop saying talking out of your ass. He's so ridiculous. Just any fucking thought that he just spews it. It's verbal diarrhea 24/7. He's bumbling around, and the fact that he contradicts himself endlessly is not something that registers in his mind for even a split second. Okay. Okay, let's do, I think, one more before we take our final break here. I got more on this Pat Robertson-Donald Trump interview because it's a festival of stupidity. Donald Trump spoke about how he plans to fund an infrastructure bill in his interview with Pat Robertson. And his answer is golden.
And we have to fix our infrastructure. So infrastructure is very important.
Somebody suggested the Federal Reserve has a big slush fund that maybe they could pass over for infrastructure without having to raise taxes. How do you get the money for that?
Oh, we'll get the money. We're going to get the money, and we're going to grow. And I say it, we're going to have tremendous growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're being held back by all these regulations, which I'm knocking out left and right.
Yeah.
Even Dodd-Frank with the banking business. I have people, friends of mine, they want to go get a loan. They can't. Great people.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't get loans. We're doing things on Dodd-Frank in terms of the banks. We have many, many things that we're doing. But we're going to have growth. And we're going to grow out of our problems.
This guy has no clue what he's talking about. How are you going to fund an infrastructure bill? You know, we're going to grow. We're going to grow. I say it. I love that. I love that. I'm going to start doing that. In the middle of me saying something, I'm going to say, I say it. Yeah, I know. You're saying it right now. Yeah, we're going to grow. I say it. We're going to grow. Yeah, I know you're saying it. You just fucking said it. Okay, so think about that. Like, imagine... imagine crafting a policy. You're sitting at a table with a bunch of experts and economists and legal scholars, and you're like, okay, time to do our infrastructure bill. Everybody ready? Yeah, we're ready. Let's do it. All right, how are we going to fund it? And, you know, somebody's like, we're going to grow. We're going to grow. People be like, huh? What do you mean we're going to grow? We're going to grow. We're going to, the economy, we're going to cut taxes and deregulate, and we're going to grow. The economy's going to grow so much that infrastructure will pay for itself. Any serious human being, any expert or economist would go, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. So you want to do $1 trillion or more in spending and not cut anywhere else and not raise taxes, raise revenue somehow. The fuck are you? We're going to grow. We're going to grow. It's going to be great. We're going to grow. And then it gets even dumber when he says, well, you know, the answer is Dodd-Frank. We're getting rid of Dodd-Frank. So Trump's answer on how to spend infrastructure is to further deregulate Wall Street. Like, these are – he's the king of the non sequitur. How are you going to fund infrastructure? You know, Dodd-Frank, tremendously sad. I know people, good people. They can't get a loan. So we're going to deregulate Wall Street, and then that's going to fund infrastructure. That will do nothing of the sort. If you deregulate Wall Street and you cut taxes for the rich, which is exactly what he plans to do, there's going to be another boom-bust cycle in the economy. Everything takes off. We're going through that right now. Oh, my God, look, everything's great. And then, boom, there's going to be another giant crash. It's going to happen. It's always happened historically. Hear me now, quote me later. 1929, roaring 20s. Oh, my God, things are great. Boom, Great Depression. Leading up to the Great Recession. Oh, my God, things are great. Boom, Great Recession. And now we're going through another same cycle, deregulating, cutting taxes for the rich. Same thing is going to happen. But he's so stupid. He thinks, no, we're going to grow so much that we're going to be able to take a lot of that money and put it towards infrastructure. No, you're actually going to have a net loss in wealth creation, like has happened every other time you cut taxes for the rich and deregulated. So you want to talk about voodoo economics. I find it so funny that the Republicans often have this, they're caricatured or stereotyped as, or just that's, those aren't the right words. They're labeled as, well, they're the party that's more fiscally responsible, and they're the ones who really care more about the hard numbers, and they sit down and they do the budget math. And no, that's the exact opposite. I don't know. Fucking roll the dice. How are you going to fund infrastructure? Growth. Deregulate Wall Street. You know, Obama said it. I'm not the biggest Obama fan in the world, but what he said was totally true. And he's like, that's their answer for everything. Their answer for everything is cut taxes for the rich, deregulate. Cut taxes for the rich, deregulate. Cut taxes for the rich, deregulate. It never works, but they keep proposing it. Because it's almost like they don't really care about the outcomes. What they really care about is letting their rich buddies run out the back door with all the money. Okay. I lied to you. I will do one more before we take our final break. I want to show you one more moment here from the Pat Robertson Donald Trump interview because it makes me smile every time I see it. So look at how insanely disconnected from reality they both are.
We have the highest taxes anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. We're going to lower them. We're going to lower them substantially. We're going to have tremendous growth.
I'd like to make a prediction. If you get health care and tax reform.
Buffering, I don't know why. Give it a second.
You're guaranteed another 4 years in office if you want it.
Well, then I'll see you at the inauguration.
Pat, what was that? Yeah, like a random... Oh, my heart, where's my Vicodin? Pat Robertson, permanent bed posture. Oh, he had an inauguration. Why am I looking at your shoes? Forgive my hair if it's all fucked up, you know, whatever. This is so ridiculous. So there's a few things to discuss here, even though it's a really tiny clip. Trump just starts out with a total lie. Not only is that not true, that is nowhere near true. We have the highest taxes in the world. The highest taxes in the world. We're not even in the top 10. We are not even in the top 10, you lying, soulless son of a bitch. He doesn't, I swear to God, when Trump talks, he doesn't think about stuff like you or I do, how, like, when we say stuff, we're trying to categorize things in our mind. Like, okay, I need to say things that are true, so let me go to things I know and start talking and say things that are accurate. There's no, like, oh, true, not true thing in his mind. He just fucking verbal diary. We have the highest taxes in the world. The highest taxes in the world. But we don't. It's not even close. But I'm just going to say it in a really sober, serious tone, and I'm the president, so believe me. Believe me. And then Pat says if you get tax reform and health care through, you're going to get another 4 years. Okay, we just went over the details of his tax plan. It was one of the first stories we did. It blows anywhere from a $3.4 to $7.8 trillion hole in the deficit. What happened? I thought you guys were fiscally responsible. And his tax plan gives to everybody in the top 0.1%, they get an extra $937,700 a year. And for people who make $25,000 or less, which is almost half the country makes $30,000 a year or less, they get an extra $40. So it is a giant giveaway to the rich, a gigantic giveaway to the rich. I was like, yeah, if you do that giant giveaway to the rich, you're going to get another 4 years. Except polls show the American people, over 60%, want to raise taxes on the rich. So what the fuck are you talking about, Pat? But the best was the health care. If we got health care, then we can get another 4 years. Where's my neck? Trump's health care bill has an approval rating of 16%. It is literally the most unpopular bill in 3 decades. In an average of the polls, it's like 28% favorability rating. I've seen numbers as low as 16%. What is it like to be one of these guys where they just say shit? They don't read. They don't care about actual information. They just fucking, it's verbal diarrhea all day. Highest taxes in the world. No. If you get health care, you're going to get reelected, even though only 16% of Americans want it. Where's my vaccine? None of it is true. None of it is true, and you don't care. Your little babies playing for your team, the Republican team and Team Trump. Everything else be damned. You don't care about any information. Fuck all of it. I'm Team Trump, and Trump's Team Trump. And that's all we care about. Little toddlers, man. That's what it feels like. Okay. All right, let's take our final break. When we come back, I got 3 more stories for you, including an update on the war on drugs and a terrible update coming out of Yemen and Saudi Arabia. And then the media just adores George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. And I hate that they adore them. So we'll talk about all that and more. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back. Yeah. Final
feel like I'm a woman being male.
Few stories of the week.
Cause I can lock a trap down by myself.
But don't worry, they're goodens. There's some goodens here. Mm-hmm. I just morphed into a cowboy from 1872. I got some goodens here. Good stories. Mm-hmm. I have some good news here about the war on drugs coming out of Oregon. This is from the Washington Post. First-time offenders caught with small amounts of heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and other illegal drugs will face less jail time and smaller fines under a new bill approved by the Oregon legislature that aims to curb mass incarceration. The Oregon legislature passed a bill late last week that reclassifies possession of several drugs from a felony to a misdemeanor, reducing the punishments and expanding access to drug treatment for people without prior felonies or convictions for drug possession. Oregon lawmakers hope to encourage drug users to seek help rather than filling up the state's prisons as an epidemic of abuse spreads. So, many articles are classifying this as decriminalization, but that's not decriminalization. Decriminalization means it is simply not a crime. So, in other words, it's not legal, but it's not a crime if you're caught with drugs. Here, what they're saying is first-time offenders face smaller fines, less jail time and smaller fines. And they'll probably use some prosecutorial discretion, and they'll say, yeah, you know, whatever, for somebody caught with a small amount of marijuana or cocaine or whatever, we might not even try to get any jail time, even though we technically still could try to get jail time. It would just be a smaller amount of jail time and a smaller fine. So they're basically trying to retool stuff slowly but surely and move it in the direction of rehabilitation. And what's sad is this is a story. Like, we view it as a novel idea. Like, oh, look at this new thing people are trying. But that's such – it should have been the case a long, long time ago, man. Like, the idea that, hey, maybe somebody struggling with addiction or something needs medical treatment and not to be locked in a cage, the idea that that wasn't already the dominant philosophy that has been implemented for decades is just maddening. Because you shouldn't, like, you don't get to pretend you're in favor of freedom and liberty and justice and then, you know, defend this mass incarceration epidemic we have, where we're locking up more people than China, and I almost sound like I'm China, where we're locking up more people than them, and we act like, well, what do you mean? This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. Free to do what? Obviously not free to take a substance that, you know, tweaks your consciousness. And again, remember, decriminalization and legalization are very different things. People know who listen to the show that I'm in favor of legalizing, taxing, and regulating. But decriminalization is just like the baby step, the common sense baby step of, like, I don't know, let's not ruin lives over drugs, maybe. And now you have some places that are just starting to come around to that position, which is good to see, but it's, you know, damning with faint praise, because I wish it was decades and decades ago that we started doing this. But what we really need is at the federal level, we need to decriminalize drug possession. And look, there's been a lot of crazy stories and admissions around this particular issue. I mean, remember, it was a high-ranking official in Nixon's administration who came out and said, oh, yeah, the reason we did the war on drugs was to crack down on liberal white people. I think they said hippies and black people. They said, yeah, they weren't going to be people who were ever going to be on our side, who were ever going to be a coalition for us. So we wanted to criminalize those populations however we could. And how do we criminalize population? Well, a lot of them like to smoke marijuana. They're the free love and anti-war movement. So, yeah, a lot of them do drugs. So let's make drugs illegal. And then, you know, over $1 trillion later and countless people locked up, and countless deaths as a result of the drug war, because it's a literal war where thousands of people have died on the Mexican border. And the drug cartels are incredibly powerful. It's a narco state in places of Mexico. This is where we're at. We're at a point where people are still taking the same amount of drugs they took before, if not more, and you just wasted $1 trillion. and you created a powerful black market. Look, that's the thing that people really don't ever talk about, even though they should, which is decriminalization is just the first step in the conversation, but how did we defeat, you know, all the problems and ills associated with prohibition? By getting rid of prohibition, by legalizing alcohol consumption again. Because when we had prohibition, what happened? The mafia got incredibly powerful because they had a monopoly on the alcohol market. They would sell it on the black market, and they got really rich and really powerful as a result of it, and crime rose. Because whenever there was a dispute, you settle it with guns in the street as opposed to going to court. So it's the same thing with the drug cartels. The reason the drug cartels are so powerful is because drugs are still illegal. But we've already seen the beginnings of it in places like, you know, obviously some states have legalized recreational marijuana, Washington, Colorado, California. And apparently there have been articles about how that's really hurting the drug cartels. So the last thing they want is for there to be, you know, legal, taxed, and regulated drugs, because then that undercuts them. Because what would you do? Would you rather go to, you know, a safe market and go get drugs when you know it's regulated and stuff like that, or would you rather go to some weirdo, some creep in a back alley? I think you know the answer to that. And people, a lot of people are just willing to pay higher prices just to go to the market so that they get it and everything's kind of straightforward and above the table. And we saw this in Nevada. They recently legalized recreational marijuana. They ran out of it in like a few days. The governor declared a statement of emergency and said, yeah, we got to find a way to, you know, resupply these people, these distributors, because damn, this is selling fast. It's a lot of tax revenue for the state, and it's a whole lot of upsides. So there we have it, Oregon taking a baby step in the right direction. I'd like to see a lot more states do this, and I'd like everybody to go further at a federal level as well. Okay. Which one should we do? I got two stories left. I'm going to go to George W. Bush and Bill Clinton first, and then we'll end on the serious note. Okay, here we go. The media is absolutely fawning over a moment shared between George W. Bush and Bill Clinton the other night. Let's run the clip here, then I want to vomit afterwards.
The best thing can happen to you in your politics is to be consistently underestimated.
That's pretty good at that. Last thing before we go tonight, former Presidents George W. Bush and William J. Clinton spoke at a presidential leadership forum in Dallas, Texas tonight. And in what seems to be a partisan political landscape these days, there is one friendship worth remembering. As Bush 43 called it tonight, one of the most unique and important relationships in U.S. history, that of his father, Bush 41, and President Clinton.
He was humble in victory, which is very important in dealing with other people. And I think Dad was willing to rise above the political contest. In other words, it starts with the individual's character. And both men, in my judgment, displayed a strong character, and therefore their friendship was able to be formed. Now, why do I have a friendship with him? Well, because he's called a brother with a different mother.
Former President George W. Bush tonight at the library that bears his name.
I really disliked, like, the veneration of former presidents simply based on the fact that they're former presidents. Look, you have to earn that. You have to earn it. And they didn't earn it. I mean, of course, Clinton wasn't as bad as Bush, but he's pretty bad. I mean, he signed Graham-Leach-Bliley, which repealed Glass-Steagall. It's one of the reasons why we had the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession. He signed NAFTA. That's not good. When you look at George W. Bush, do I even need to get into it? War in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, torture. The list goes on and on, you know. Hundreds of thousands of civilians killed under him. tax cuts for the rich, deregulation of Wall Street even further, Patriot Act. Like, I, part of me is like, whatever, Kyle, relax. They're just doing, you know, quick little thing at the end of the show. But I don't know, man. There's something really, like, broken about a society that kind of venerates people solely based on their title, their title. Like, no, you need to – and that's the other thing. Notice the stories that they tell and what they're showing here, what is it about? It's about, you know, personal anecdotes. Like, oh, I met him and he was nice, and it's about being humble in victory, and it's good to be underestimated, and yada, yada. You want to know why they are talking about that stuff and covering that stuff? Because they, what the fuck policy accomplishments are they going to talk about? What they actually do for the country? If you have a conversation about FDR, within the first minute, somebody goes, New Deal. New Deal. New Deal. Tremendous. Amazing. You talk about these guys. Yeah, you know, it was cool. He had a relationship with my dad, and they were friendly, and they were humble, and it's good to be underestimated, and personal anecdotes, stories about, you know, how they are when they're one-on-one. It's never, hey, remember when you did X, Y, and Z, because X, Y, and Z, the overwhelming majority of the time with these two, was negative. So, I don't know, man. I know I'm a little bit, I know I'm a lot of a curmudgeon and stuff, but it just annoys me, the veneration for veneration's sake. The job of the media is to be a watchdog of those in power, not to do their casual fluff pieces, like we're seeing here, where you portray them, giggly, yay, ex-presidents, look at them, it's like a buddy comedy, look at them, they're wacky, and they're going to go to fucking Denny's together, and they're going to make jokes with the waitress. Stop. I don't like it. Yeah, so there you go. Maybe I'm being a little too much of a curmudgeon, but it annoys me. It annoys me when we put people like that on a pedestal when they didn't earn it. I mean, what is it that Noam Chomsky said? If the Nuremberg laws were upheld, every post-World War II American president would be hanged. Damn, son. Okay, final story of the day. And we are definitely going to be getting out of here early. Probably about 10 minutes early. Wow. I breeze through these stories today. Ain't that something? Okay. It's not like I had a full show, too. Wow. Hey, like them apples. All right, here we go. The government is failing to do even the most basic civilian protections when it comes to foreign policy. So listen to this story from The Intercept. Last October, an airstrike in Yemen by the Saudi Arabia-led coalition hit a funeral, killing more than 130 people and drawing global condemnation. Yet in the months following that strike, the United States doubled the amount of fuel it provided to coalition jets, doubled, according to figures obtained by the U.S. military, from the U.S. military. The numbers underline the fact that U.S. support for the campaign has continued and even increased despite growing attention to civilian casualties and alleged war crimes by the coalition. But the House of Representatives just passed over the chance to vote on legislation that would attract the fuel the Pentagon gives to the Saudi coalition and prohibited refueling of coalition aircraft unless the Pentagon could assure Congress that subsequent missions wouldn't hit civilians or targets contained on no-strike lists. An amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act filed by Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna of California with bipartisan support failed to pass the Rules Committee last night, and so it won't be up for a vote. So this is yet another example of Justice Democrat Ro Khanna doing tremendous work and doing the right thing repeatedly in what he's pushing for. But how sad is that? That they couldn't get something passed that prohibits refueling of the Saudi coalition unless we can assure limited civilian casualties. So this is just an admission by the U.S. Like, yeah, we don't really care if you massacre civilians if you're our ally. If you're our ally and you're our business partner, you get to do whatever you want to do, and we're still going to pretend like you're in favor of freedom and liberty and justice, and you care about human rights. Again, even when our top allies, who? Saudi Arabia. Yeah, they care about freedom and liberty and justice? Please. Israel. They care about freedom and liberty and justice? They're doing permanent occupation and apartheid. They're expanding settlements even further, taking more and more Palestinian land. Saudi Arabia, everybody knows, because I say it a few times a week, every week. They say all atheists are terrorists. Women are second-class citizens. They can't drive. They need a guardian. They behead people in public square for sorcery and witchcraft and apostasy. They're slaughtering women and children in Yemen right now. They're bombing civilian targets on purpose. They've attacked mosques. They've attacked open-air markets. They've attacked schools, schools for the blind, hospital. I mean, and they were given the option and the opportunity. Hey, do you guys think maybe we should ban refueling the planes if they're attacking civilian targets? And Congress said, no, we shouldn't. Because they care more about getting more money to Raytheon and Boeing and the defense contractors than they care about innocent women and children being obliterated in Yemen. So, this is what our government's doing with our money in our name. And when somebody stands up and does the right thing, they look them in the eye and say, fuck off, we don't care. It really is a genuinely depressing feeling I get when I read these kinds of stories. It really is. Okay. There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Got your Friday show. We really did breeze through it. I mean, I'm 10 minutes early here, so I would stay and do a song and dance and do some show tunes for you, but that's not going to happen. So I guess I wouldn't do that. All right, guys. I love you, and we will see everybody back here same time, same place on Monday. You know the deal. Everybody have a good weekend. Peace. Mwah.